She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everyone. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. Thank you so much for joining us today and for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. This show is sponsored by Chapman Tucson, and we appreciate their support. Not to mention that I love my VW Jetta TDI. It's not only clean birding, but I get about 40 to 45 miles per gallon, lots of times 40 miles per gallon in town, and I love the clean burning. You can visit them at chapmantucson.com. So I am over the top, almost goofy excited about today's guest. We have wanted to have her on for a very long time. She is a game changer. She's an early adopter. The content of the show might be one of the most important topics that we can discuss as a planet. It's a global issue. Her name is Amy Califa, and I hope I said that right, Amy.
You got it.
Filmmaker, angry mom, also mother, and creative force behind the movie Two Angry Moms. We'll be talking about the movie, talking about children's health, and about some of Amy's upcoming project. And as I said, I can't think of a more timely nor a more important topic than children's health. So Amy, welcome, and I just have a few quick announcements, and then it's all about you.
Thanks for having me on the show, Gina.
Okay, Mrs. Green's World is also a part of the Dream Vision 7 radio network, and the nice thing about that is that Amy's show will be aired again to over 500,000 subscribers on that network a week from this Monday, which is wonderful, double exposure. And please remember to join me every Saturday at noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. I want to remind you that if you can't make the show at noon on Saturday because lots of you are busy then, we get the podcast up pretty quickly within usually 24 hours, or you can listen on your iPhone or Droid as you're going about your busy Saturdays. All the podcasts of the show are on my website. And of course, my little shout out, stay connected with me on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and YouTube. If you have questions, email me at MrsGreensWorld.com. And this is where I do my weekly shout out for another one of our sponsors, and I hopefully come up with fresh and exciting new content each week. The name of their company is Ecobella, and it's ECCO, two E's, ecobella.com. And I don't think it's much of a stretch to say for this show that Sally Malanga was one angry person when she was frustrated about what was in her skincare products. So she did what any reasonable woman, and I have to say woman because there's three of us now I'm talking about in this conversation, she started her own company. Ecobella's products, from their skincare to their makeup to their air fresheners, are all things that I have grown to admire and respect. They are cruelty-free. It really matters. They are organic, and they are natural. And it was a long time ago. She was an early adopter. I'm proud to say that I have switched many of my products to Ecobella's skincare. I'm very pleased with the results. My air freshener is just legend here in Mrs. Green's house because it's made from essential oils. And when I spray it, it smells like we just peeled a bunch of oranges. It's absolutely and positively refreshing. No chemicals. Their stuff is gluten-free, no talc. And as I said, never tested on animals. So if you're looking for some really great, natural, healthy, good company values, skincare or makeup, ecobella.com. Thanks so much. Okay. One more thing, and then it's like, Amy, I'm dying to get to this conversation, but anybody listening from anywhere in the world, voting begins this coming Monday, October 22nd, for Arizona's Greenest Workplace Challenge, and I'm proud to say that we do have people listen to us from all over the world, so vote. It doesn't matter if you're from Arizona. We have great companies, we have great judges, and we have a People's Choice Award, so cast your vote, support green businesses that are committed to sustainable practices that are making a difference for you and for me because of what they do to make the world a better place. Okay, now let the excitement and education and focus on your amazing, game-changing world begin. Amy, filmmaker, Two Angry Moms, where should we start? Should we start about children's health, Amy? Is that a good kickoff point? You were frustrated.
Sure. I was frustrated, and sure, that's a really great place to start because that's where I started. And, you know, it was really just hearing the dire statistics about children's health is one thing. But when it's kind of in your face, as it was for me, I just kept feeling like I knew something and I wanted to do something about it. But I'm not a scientist. I'm not a researcher. You know, I'm not the person who's going to find the cure to all diseases. But I am a mom. So, you know, at the time I had two teenage daughters and they had kids, you know, close friends that they'd grown up with all since nursery school and whatever. And these kids, by the time they got to be teenagers, were having just such horrible and dramatic health problems, you know, emotional issues, behavioral issues, hospitalizations. I couldn't help connecting it to how I'd seen these children eating all through their developmental years. You know, there was the one girl who'd come over to our house and sit, eat nothing but chicken nuggets, and I had to keep a certain kind of chicken nuggets in the freezer.
Right, right.
For when the child came over, because that's all she ever ate. And another girl who ate nothing but bagels and cream cheese. And, you know, I think our culture, I mean, there's a lot of finger pointing and we blame parents and, you know, parents get a bad rap. I don't know, the parents have no discipline and all of that. But our culture really promotes this. Everywhere we go, there's kids' menus and, you know, I mean, school food, no better. The schools have totally bought into the fast food culture. But when I saw the ultimate effect, at least this in part, was having on my kids' friends, I really felt like I had to do something. I'd fed my kids healthy, organic whenever I could. We grow a lot of our own food, but I had kept it a secret really all my life because people made fun of me for what I ate.
You know, it's so interesting to hear this dialogue. I'm quite a bit older than you, but I was one of those moms, and I thought I was a great mom. And my daughter, my youngest daughter, and I laugh because my husband and I would take turns taking her to school. And Amy, honestly, we'd go to McDonald's, and I don't want to bash McDonald's. I don't like to bash on the show, but every day that's what we'd get for breakfast. And then people like you started seeping into my life and waking me up. And I will tell you right now, my children, they have me over healthy eating all day long and twice on Sunday. They are such healthy eaters, all three daughters. And they teach me. So I want to like ring the bell for you, and I like ringing the bell. I think that's kind of a fun little sound. It's a little touch. It's like, what can I do? So please go on, because it is my gratitude for people like you that made me wake up and say, like, chicken McNuggets now, I can barely say the words. It like catches in my throat because that's not real food. So
well, you know, I that is very gratifying to hear you say that you listen to people and you changed, and it's really had an influence on your daughters, because I really hate to be that shrill person. And, you know, especially when I read in the media, I've been called things like nutrition Nazi and the food police and all of
proud
that.
Proud of it.
Well, I'm trying to be proud of it, but it doesn't sit well with me because I don't see myself as a really kind of shrill person.
At all.
But I just kind of realized I had to stand up. And, you know, I have a quote that I wrote about in my book that my younger daughter, when one of her very best friend had to be hospitalized actually in another state for being like the youngest child ever to be diagnosed with anorexia. She kind of looked at me, and, you know, we've always been kind of considered wacky and eccentric because of our food ways. And she said, "So does this mean we're the normal ones?"
I love it.
Really made me realize that, you know, maybe if what we do was considered normal, kids would be healthier. And so that really gave me the impetus I needed. And I'm a filmmaker. I've been a filmmaker all my life, so I know how to make a movie. But this was a whole other thing, because I'd always, you know, really been doing kind of work for hire or other kinds of non-controversial documentaries, and I really realized I had to step out of the box. So I went and started studying nutrition so that I would have those facts at my fingertips, and put up a website, and met up with a lot of moms who really were concerned, but they'd all tried to do things. And, you know, I started focusing on schools just because I figured that was a way that we could really reach the most amount of people.
Right, shift the masses in a shorter amount of time. Great. Right,
yeah.
Right.
So it's not like, oh, it's just school food that's bad and all food everywhere else is good and that's it. It's just really that food, you know, the school food is kind of a microcosm for the food in our larger society, whether it's your family going to McDonald's, you know, every day, or going to the grocery store and buying lots of frozen processed foods, whatever it is, it's the American way. And so I thought, well, if we could begin to change that in schools, it takes the onus off of asking every individual parent to do this at home when the whole dominant culture is against them, and maybe trying to change an institution. So I started looking at schools, and I met these parents who had tried, but they just run up against such a bureaucracy, such red tape, such resistance from administrators and school food service. They had given up. And I finally was led to this one mom, Dr. Susan Rubin, who had been doing this for 10 years in
right.
her community. And she hadn't given up. And so she really inspired me. And, you know, just based on a conversation we had, she said something like, well, we're just two angry moms trying to change school food. And I loved that.
And
I,
it was born.
That's the name of the movie. Yeah. So what I did was I followed her around locally. She's about a half an hour away from me in another community, and she had formed at that point a coalition of parents and administrators and teachers in her whole county. It was a county in New York State, and they were really starting to get things done by going outside of the local school district and you know, forming a larger group countywide. So one particular district, we felt they were really had a chance to make some changes. So I followed that district over the course of a school year to see how the process of organizing and then creating, you know, new policy and then implementing that policy would go. And then at the same time, I set out on a quest on my own all across the country to find model school food programs, because I have seen so many documentaries that are really great, really powerful, but you walk out of the theater feeling like you want to kill yourself.
Right, like what am I going to do now? Seriously,
exactly.
Yes, right. What's
so
my call to action?
Yeah, so I didn't want to make another scary film. I really wanted to show people what is being done, what they could do, how you can get involved, and you know, you don't have to take it on all by yourself, and all of those important things to make it something that seems attainable. And so that's what I did. I did the filming over the course of a year, and then it took a year to do all the editing. And then we released the film. It's been out since 2008, and it's still quite relevant. So people are using it as a tool. You know, you can show
educate.
It in your community.
Yes.
Exactly. It's great for PTO meetings, for like library events, for food film series, all these kinds of things. And then it helps people get organized in the website, which is angrymoms.org, is really an adjunct to the movie that has all the tools you need to host a screening, ways to get connected. We have a new site now that you can get to from our main site if you just click on Join the Movement. And that's it's a dedicated social network so that parents and everybody can find one another by their zip code, by their school district, and form their own local organizations. And it's a way to share all kinds of information.
So you know, you and I spoke very briefly before the show, and I shared with you that I am not an expert, and I did not study, you know, children's health and nutrition, but I am a prolific reader in the past 4.5 years, a voracious reader about health and children's health and the health of the planet as it relates to food. So I know what I think, but you are much more of an expert. Do you really think there is a crisis in children's health today?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the statistics bear it out. At this point now, we've got 35% of American children who are obese or at risk of becoming obese, and that's 2 or 3 times the amount that we saw just a generation ago. You know, everybody tends to focus on obesity, but that's really the tip of the iceberg. iceberg.
It is. You know? There are so many other things.
Yeah. You know, so the predictions now, and this is the CDC, this isn't some obscure agency, they're saying that 30% of boys, 40% of girls born in the year 2000 will develop type 2 diabetes, which used to be called adult onset diabetes, but they can't call it that anymore because so many kids are getting it now.
And now it's an epidemic.
It's an epidemic. And as our, you know, asthma, ADHD, anxiety, I mean, anxiety disorders in kids, autism, depression, you know, just these disorders that you never used to see in children, bipolar disorder. At this point, 1 in 4 American children take prescription medicine every day
for a
chronic illness.
That just is so sick to me. It's so sad.
Oh
my gosh, that's really, I don't want to get carried away.
But you know, when I sent my younger daughter on, it was a school overnight and there were medical forms to fill out and I just kind of, you know, put little slash marks through all the boxes and they called me, the school called me and said, well, we didn't get her medication form. And I said, yeah, I turned it in. They said, well, but it's all just filled out with slash marks. I said, well, that's because she doesn't take
that
medication.
That is so sad. That is just like really so sad. And there's a part of the film which I have not seen, which I commit to on the air, and I'm going to talk to one of my team members who is an incredible mom with 2 young children about doing a showing for people with Mrs., you know, that are connected to Mrs. Green's world. I've watched clips, you know, I did my homework, but there's a particular segment of the film that a 6-minute segment that you said when it was released, it caused a lot of controversy, and now your early adopter behavior or sharing the messenger has caught up with it. And I shared with you a personal story about a friend of mine this morning who shared with me that his very bright, very wonderful son has been diagnosed with Asperger's. And I thought it was so on purpose that I was interviewing you right after he told me that. And we talked about it. So what's your, just expand on that.
Yeah, well, you know, this whole, I mean, autism rates, especially among boys, I think they've gone up something like 150-fold. And now there's, I think it's one in every 150 boys born is diagnosed with autism, and Asperger's is what they call one of those autism spectrum disorders for, like, high-functioning kids but still have symptoms of autism. And when I first was editing the film, I had filmed a story of a family who their son at the age of 2 years old was diagnosed with autism. He had all the characteristics, you know, couldn't make eye contact. He would just like bang his head into a wall. He couldn't be taken out in any social situation and had no communication skills, you know, really severe autism. And she, being a mom, started doing her research and learned about dietary changes. There's a whole bunch of different diets with different names, but essentially most of them consist of removing all chemical ingredients from the food and removing, in many cases, gluten products and casein, which is the protein in milk, really eliminating anything that can cause inflammation in a child's system. And then along with that, doing a whole spectrum of kind of detox under medical supervision that helps get toxins out of the body. And when I met this family, the boy was 6 years old, and they had had to remove him from the school that he'd been in and put him in a new school because he was no longer autistic. And nobody would believe that, you know, you could reverse that. So he had this diagnosis and this label, even though he exhibited absolutely no symptoms of autism. He's now 10 years old and doing just beautifully. Just beautifully. But when I put that segment into the film, everybody who watched it in my focus group says, this ruins the credibility of your film because nobody's going to believe that this is a true story. And I actually removed that piece from the film, so you won't see it in the movie. But the kind of cool thing is that another friend of mine has asked me to consult on a new film that's just going into production, and that film is actually all about this topic. She's following a number of families of children like your friend who has a diagnosis of autism, and she's putting them on an 18-month program, nutrition and holistic healing, and she's going to follow these kids and see how they do.
When you talk about detoxing, can you just expand on that a little bit? I don't, I think it's a complicated subject, and I know a little bit enough about it to be dangerous, but can you expand on that? Because I know that children are born, when they test what's in children's bodies when they're born, it's enough to make you weep. I mean, there's arsenic, and there's Ambien, and there's, you know, you name it. So
you
tell
name it, and rocket fuel, you know, these really scary substances. Well, I am also not a medical person, so I'm probably just as dangerous as you are if I speak on this subject, but what it is they, I know they use things that are called chelation agents, and what those do is, and they're natural, you know, they're natural substances, and they bind in your body, in your bloodstream, to toxins that could, probably mostly heavy metals, things like mercury.
Right.
And
lead. Probably not lead, because lead's really bad.
Right, but I believe that they can actually help get the lead out. They can chelate, those kinds of things. And all of these toxins, you know, I think the theory is that it's just these little growing baby bodies are born or early in life accumulate such an overload of toxins. You know, there's that whole issue of whether autism is caused by vaccines. And I mean, it could be one piece of the puzzle is the toxins in a vaccine. But I think it's really just looked at it now by these doctors as a toxic overload. So what they try to do is really get all the toxins, or as many as they can, out of the child's body down to a level at which they can tolerate. Because we all have toxins in our body, and, you know, our natural function is to detox on a daily basis. But when it gets to such a high level, you just can't do that, and so you start to malfunction, and you get these neurological kinds of disorders. And this theory, which is still a theory, seems to be working, at least in many cases.
Which seems to be, you know, the theories until it's totally tested just seem to me absolutely long and serious. Okay, we have to take a quick break, which really annoys me because I don't want to, but we have to. So we're listening to Amy Califa, filmmaker, mother, and talking to us about Two Angry Moms. Please stay here with me. We will be right back.
University of Arizona professor John Pollard asked the students in the Posada San Pedro Hall to consider bringing solar energy to the dorm. Just 3 years later, the Solar Cats, a group of students who took up the cause, have installed 44 solar panels on the dorm, saving 20,000 kilowatt hours of energy and reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 14 metric tons every year. Talk about students with a sunny future. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
She's the most exciting thing that's ever happened to you, and you want to spend eternity with her. She deserves nothing less than the best, an Abbott Taylor original. A diamond engagement ring as exceptional as she is that will make her eyes sparkle every time she sees it. Because we design and make our own jewelry, we can create something wonderful for every budget. I'm Abbott Taylor. I'd like to invite you to come see what Abbott Taylor Jewelers has waiting for you. With 35 years and thousands of original jewelry designs, no one has more experience in designing and making diamond jewelry in Tucson than Abbott Taylor Jewelers. We're proud to say using recycled gold, we have saved over 100 million pounds of toxic waste from this planet. Abbott Taylor Jewelers at 6383 East Grant Road, on Facebook, and on the web at atdiamonds.com. Abbott Taylor Jewelers. Diamond designs for everyone. Abbott Taylor Jewelers.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green. Did you know that the 2012 VW Beetle has been completely redesigned, that it has exciting new features, look, and performance, and that it is one of Oprah's best things for 2012? The best news is Chapman VW has them in stock. Check out the new Beetle at Chapman VW at 4600 East 22nd Street between Columbus and Swan, or visit them at TucsonVW.com. Be sure to tell them that Mrs. Green sent you.
You know how they say your donation to Goodwill changes lives?
Well, it's true.
It's true.
Well, it's true.
Goodwill.
Goodwill gave my son a chance.
My mom, hope.
My brother, a sense of purpose.
And help my dad find a job.
Goodwill helps thousands of people.
People like us every year.
People like us.
Every year.
Your donations to Goodwill do change lives. Please donate today.
Are you thinking about swapping out your old items for new? Think Habitat when you do. Don't trash it. Have a store it. Habitat for Humanity Tucson will resell your donated furniture, appliances, and building supplies and use the proceeds to build affordable homes in the greater Tucson area. Call now at 520-889-7200 for a free pickup. You can bring your donations to Habitat's Have a Store at 935 West Grant Road, just a quarter mile east of I-10. For more information, go to habitattucson.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to, and hopefully we are giving you a great deal to think about. Our guest today is Amy Califa. She is a filmmaker, an angry mom, kind of, in the most wonderful way, and an advocate for children's health, sharing with us what is on her big agenda for changing the world one child at a time, focusing on their health. So Amy, again, thank you for taking the time to be on the show. I want to follow up on something you said about autism. And there's a part of this that I don't understand, and if you don't, it's fine. Some news that I got very recently was from a friend of a friend who had a little boy, healthy, doing great, 12 months old, you know, ahead of all those awful charts where they measure kids against each other. I never like those. He's in the 90th percentile for weight and, you know, height, whatever. But 18 months, he now has been diagnosed as autistic. Perfectly normal. What happens? You know, to me, I start going to my absolutely, you know, Lucy 5 cents. It's the food, it's the environment, it's the cleaning solutions in the house. And I don't want to be that shrill person either. So what's your observation, or what have you heard about that? That's so shocking to me.
You know, I don't think anybody can yet tell you what happens. But in my mind, I would say it's probably all of the above. You know, it's probably not any one thing.
Right, it's the cocktail,
genetic,
the toxic cocktail.
It's a cocktail, and you know, more and more research is coming out with every disease that we find or disorder of the interaction of our genes and the environment. So if you look at it like that, it's an interaction of some kind, and nobody can really say it's this one chemical or it's this one thing that the parents did or it's this gene. It's all of the above. And so what we really have to bear in mind is that these kids are like the canaries in the coal mine. They're giving us a warning that something's wrong. Something's very wrong in the environment of our children, because our genes probably aren't mutating so fast that this is a crazy genetic, you know, mutation. More than likely, it's something in the environment that's interacting with our children's bodies that they can't handle. So If you go on that theory, and this is what we were talking about earlier, and you work with a doctor and you work with a nutritionist to change the whole chemical and ecological makeup of a child's body, and this applies not just for autism, but you know, many of these other childhood disorders that we're seeing now, whether it's asthma or whether it's a learning disorder or an anxiety disorder. A lot of them can be either reversed or alleviated greatly. The symptoms can be alleviated by just lowering the toxic load in the kid's body.
Yeah, and so much has changed. Like, I think about my niece. She was 11 years old and had a sleeping disorder. And she's fine now, and she's healthy. But their doctor put her on low doses of Ambien. She literally could not sleep. And in our day and age, I'm telling you what, kiddo, we ran hard, played hard, did our homework, went out, and had the neighborhood. We played every game you can think of, couldn't wait to get the homework out. That has changed so much. Kids are sedentary. They're hooked up to electronic devices. I mean, there's so much that can contribute to this, and it kind of makes me sad. So that's like editorial comment. But the movie, talk about what the movie is actually about. Give us some highlights, sure. And let's pique people's interest, and we have to tell people how they get it so I can get it too.
Sure. Well, there's a number of ways you can get it, but the easiest way is if you just go to the website. It's angrymoms.org. You can order the DVD, and I will tell you before I tell you all the details of what's in it, it's available in a number of different versions now because we've had so many requests for different versions.
Which is wonderful.
Yeah. Originally, it's an 86-minute feature film. And then people asked for a 60-minute version so they could show it at meetings and seminars and workshops and things like that. So we made a 60-minute version. And then we have a Spanish edition. A wonderful group out of Dallas, Altrucia, sponsored a Spanish edition. So it's dubbed. It's not exactly, well, yeah, it's dubbed into Spanish. So
right.
We didn't want to do subtitles, so we just redid all the voices in Spanish. So that's really cool. And so all of those versions are available on the website. And so what's in the film? As I was saying earlier, I didn't want to make a film that would depress people. I wanted it to be used as a tool. So the film really shows, it models how one community was able to go from using, you know, a lot of highly processed, you know, what we would basically consider junk food, chicken nuggets and fingers and, you know, what they call popcorn chicken. So various versions of shredded, manufactured, rehashed chicken.
And, parts is parts.
Parts is parts and, you know, fried, various versions of fried potatoes as the main meal, to actual real healthy fresh food. So how did they do it? It shows how parents got together. It shows how they worked with their Board of Education. It shows how they looked at their local, their district-wide wellness policy and rewrote it to require certain foods like fresh foods and no trans fats and no foods that, you know, had things in them that they didn't feel were going to be good for the kids, like certain additives and artificial sweeteners and sugars and things like that. And then how they put that policy into practice by hiring a chef, by, you know, going through every item that was in the cafeteria and replacing it with a healthier item. And then what I also did in the film was travel all across the country. So I started out locally at a private school and saw how they had implemented this amazing food program where the kids really participate. So the kids, you know, they get educated by the chef in the cafeteria. The chef comes out and shows them an important ingredient, like today we're having quinoa salad. And he tells them the story of quinoa and what a wonderful grain it was and how it was the strength of all the ancient civilizations in South America and how it's very high in protein and it's actually not even a grain. It's a legume, even though we use it like a grain. And then how he's prepared it in this delicious salad and the kids get to taste it. And it's just wonderful. And then at this school, the children were growing food in a school garden. They were helping to harvest the food and turn it into a meal that they were going to use in their cafeteria. And these kids actually even help clean up at the tables, and they sit communally at tables of different age groups, and they sit with teachers. So that was a great model, but it was a private school, and I really, really wanted to see if you could do this in a public school. And it took me the better part of a year to find model programs where things like this were going on in public schools. And at that time, you know, eventually I did, but I had to travel around the whole country, and the best program I found was in Berkeley, California.
Shocking, but not.
Shocking, right? Well,
at all.
It's kind of legendary now.
Yes.
It was being run by Chef Ann Cooper, who calls herself the Renegade Lunch Lady.
I have had her on the show, Chef Ann.
And wonderful. And, you know, it was Chef Alice Waters, who's famous from Chez Panisse and the Edible Schoolyard, who had really kind of gotten things going in Berkeley. And so Berkeley really became a model for many, many, many other districts in the country. And the great thing is now that those model programs in the movie, like when I went to write my book Lunch Wars, which was much more recently, there were so many, many more programs, and they were beyond model. You know,
so, and it's great to measure that progress when you look back.
Yeah.
It's got to feel really good to you.
It does
to see the evolution.
Yes, and that these kinds of programs are influencing, you know, one district will influence a neighboring district. And my goal for the film by the end was, okay, this is Berkeley, California. You know, I live in New England. Most of my food comes from California, 1,500 miles away, or more than that. It's like 3,000 miles away. So how could we do a program like that in the Northeast when we're talking about, you know, local food and fresh and all that? And I did find programs in New Hampshire and in various other places in the Northeast that I was able to show in the movie, and then even more of them that I write about in the book. And there's a lot happening now right around where I am in Connecticut. And, it's exciting for me to be part of it on a local level now, too, because I did have to travel the country 5 years ago to find it. And that's, you know, so the book really details then, like, the how to do what you saw in the movie. That's kind of the follow-on.
So could we talk a little bit about, this is troublesome, but I know more now, 4.5 years later, than I did. One of the things that gets popped up and put in front of us is the whole socioeconomic barriers. And I, for 35 years, worked with at-risk children and families, all below the poverty level, all eligible for every type of, you know, food stamps and school lunches. And yet, at first blush, it would seem like, well, this is great if you have the means and you're middle class and you can have a garden. What I'm finding now that gives me so much hope, not so. Some of our schools here in Tucson, in some of the highest risk areas, it blows me away what they're doing. And we're talking public schools with gardens and chickens and unbelievable things, so that when you learn at school, children can take it home. And I've talked to some moms that are single moms that say it was a lot cheaper to eat the 99 cents extra value meal, but it was, through education, killing my children, and now we make different kinds of sacrifices. So what's your thoughts on that? Even community food banks are feeding people healthier food.
Yeah, and it's such a good and important point that you bring up, and I'm glad to hear that they're doing these kinds of things in Tucson, because I haven't been there yet in my travel.
Yet, and I can't wait till you do come.
I would love to. I really would. And I think, you know, the socioeconomic divide, of course, is very real, and this is all the more dire. I mean, one reason I chose to focus on school food rather than on just, you know, food
in the home,
right. It's because of the socioeconomic issues, and that, you know, more than half of the children in America are eligible for free or subsidized lunch. So that means they're living below a certain, poverty marker. And many of them, this is the main source of food that they're going to have in a day. So all the more reason why we should not only be feeding them nutritionally, but modeling for them what good healthy food is, because this is what they're learning. And so it actually turns out, as you suggest, that there are a lot of opportunities in the whole school food arena, even among, you know, in school districts that are economically challenged. And the reason, there's kind of two reasons that I've observed, and this is just anecdotal. Like, I live in a community that's fairly wealthy, and when I went and tried to change the food, which was the same food that kids in poorer communities were getting,
it was no different.
Everybody kind of looked at me and either was like, we don't care because I pack a lunch for my kid or whatever, or we feed my kid, you know, our kids well at home, so we don't care about the school food. Or there was a lot of defensiveness of, how dare you suggest that we're not doing the absolute best, perfect, wonderful thing for our kids, because, you know, we have the means to do it. So why, you know, how could you accuse us of not be, like what you were saying in the beginning of our interview about taking your kids to McDonald's every day. There's a lot of people that don't really want you telling them that that might not be good on a daily basis.
I know, and then, I just think about Egg McMuffins now, and I'm like, oh my gosh, and I ate them, and they smell.
I love an Egg McMuffin, though, you know.
So even a sausage McMuffin, it's like, okay, I have to put a bag over my head in Tucson now if I do that.
I know, that's what people say to me, too. If we ever catch you eating junk food, you're so busted. But, you know, everything in proportion. I mean, I think there are some foods that are absolutely bad, but I think, you know, as long as you give kids a good education, and they'll eventually be able to make those kinds of choices, as do we as adults, too. But so the other aspect of being in a community that is a needy community, I think parents and school administrators and the children themselves recognize the great need they have for good, real food. And when you find a way to help them get access to it, they appreciate it. They don't get defensive. They're like, yeah, bring it on. So what we're doing in my county in Connecticut, where we have a lot, we have the distinction of being the highest income disparity of any county in the United States. We just earned that distinction this year because we have all those very wealthy people who work on Wall Street in some of our towns, and then we have the city of Bridgeport, which is one of the poorest communities in the country. So what this group that I'm involved with, it's called the Green Village Initiative, is doing is we started building some school gardens in some of our wealthier communities, and then some of us said, you know what, we need to be doing this in Bridgeport. So our initiative now is to get a school garden at every single school in Bridgeport. We're halfway there. We're building an urban farm in Bridgeport. 2 acres of city land has been given to us, and we're doing it all in raised beds because that land, you know, is not clean enough to grow food in. But we've got farmers who are donating, you know, really healthy organic topsoil to fill these beds. And it's going to, the food is going to go back to the community, and it's going to go to the schools. So very exciting. And it's been, we're welcome in that community. I mean, people are so excited, and they're learning, and, you know, the ideas that the teachers in the schools, and it's already happening, are taking on these projects for themselves. So we're kind of getting it started, and then the community is going to take it on, and we'll move on to another community.
And it just changes the world. There's a similar situation in Tucson, which it is the village. And what happened here, and my friends were involved with it, one of my very first show guest, she was the plastic bag lady, and she lives in Ohio now. But Lisa, they started a community garden at their elementary school. And what happened is it was surrounded by a lot of seniors. And these seniors started coming over, curious. A lot of them retired to see what was going on. And it became a multi-generational partnership of young kids, for, you know, fourth grade and under, and parents and seniors. And it was very labor intensive. You have no idea what the soil is like out here. It's, you know, it's called caliche, and it's very hard. So those things, yes, it's like clay. So that it changes the world. And we are going to have to take another short break. When we come back, I'd love to talk to you about Lunch Wars. I'd love to talk to you about a new film you're working on called Canary Kids, and anything else that you want to share with us, maybe some more success stories. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. Time is flying. We have a great guest, Amy Califa from Two Angry Moms. Please stay here with me.
Go deep underwater without getting wet. Study bugs like a real scientist. Make your shadow move in colors. These are just three reasons to visit the exciting hands-on new exhibits at the Children's Museum Tucson, the region's only museum just for kids. For 25 years, we've ignited kids' imaginations at the Children's Museum Tucson. That's something to celebrate. And admission is only $2 on the first Sunday and on the 25th of each month this whole year. Children's Museum Tucson, where imagination and learning connect.
Hi, this is Mrs. Green with some great news about the all-new 2012 VW Passat. It's 2012 Motor Trend Car of the Year, best in class for legroom, and has standard Bluetooth technology. VW thought of everything by giving the Passat a brand new sleek design that conveys confidence and assertiveness. If you're looking for the best ownership experience possible and a great new Passat, visit Chapman Tucson at 4600 East 22nd Street between Columbus and Swan.
At the University of Arizona, we're putting solar know-how to work. And it's not just our researchers. Our students are on the job as well. Our student solar racing team, using recycled solar cells from NASA, designed and built a car from scratch that gets the equivalent of over 3,000 miles per gallon. Talk about students who will go far. Really, really far. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Great, great, great show today. Our guest is Amy Califa. She is a filmmaker, an angry mom with a really strong, gentle spirit who wants to make a difference as an advocate for children's health. And she is sharing with us stories about, to me, hope, possibility, and change, because it's as simple as to know better is to do better. And Amy, thank you for helping us know better and doing what you're doing to literally change our world and help our children. There's not a greater thing that we can do.
Well, we're all in this together, and I really want to thank you for doing what you do, too, because it's all about communicating and sharing the possibilities with other people.
I am so going to be tweeting about this show and getting the word to people, the moms I know that are just so hungry for this kind of information. And I know I would like to talk to you about Lunch Wars. It's Lunch Wars, yes, and Canary Kids. But let me ask you one question that I will be mad at myself if I don't. I was very involved in following and signing petitions when they redid the School Lunch Act. And I don't know if that's the official name, but
right,
I know
right.
Chef Ann was very involved. And I can say this, I was very disappointed. It's like, I don't think of potato as a vegetable, even though I never met a French fry I didn't like. That's the truth. But it was so important to me. And what shocked me the most, Amy, is what we're up against as a country, even in that arena, which was big money, big lobbying, and big investment in the outcome from companies that didn't want us to have, you know, fewer French fries, that didn't want us to have more servings of fruit. And it's like, it was, how could I be shocked? But I was. It's like, come on, guys, this is kids. What are you talking about? Didn't care. French fry is a vegetable. Okay.
Well, so I take a slightly radical position on the potato.
I love it.
I actually tend to, you know, I agree with you. I love potatoes, and I see them as a vegetable. I mean, they're a starchy vegetable for sure. The problem I have with potatoes is that you got potatoes and you got potatoes. Now, the potatoes I grow in my garden probably have a lot more nutrition, a lot more vitamins
right.
and minerals in them than the potatoes that become French fries in our schools, because I grow my potatoes in organic soil that's been enriched, you know, with compost from my chickens, and they're biodynamic and, you know, all of that. So it may not be the same as a potato that's been grown in soil that's been depleted of,
right.
of many of its nutrients and trace minerals. That said, same thing for an apple, same thing for what we still consider the good stuff. And then if you take those potatoes and deep fry them in, you know, some kind of...
And put some fake coating on them, which makes them really taste good.
Exactly. Then I would tend to agree that they're not healthy.
Right, right. But the plain old potato, and if you get it at the farmer's market, it is a good food.
And you know, kids do need calories. And in defense of the potato, if you put lots of herbs and, you know, good quality butter or olive oil on the potato, it's a great food. So that said, you know, the regulations that went into effect this year are federal. They're not your local school wellness policy regulations. So every school district has to comply with these new regulations. And I was not as dismayed, I think, as some people. I guess maybe because I'm so steeped in this world of school
forward motion
policy.
Felt good.
Yeah, well, forward motion felt good, and in actually the film, we filmed the hearings at the Institute of Medicine where all of those food manufacturers got to testify about, you know, why everything they were doing was so good for kids. And so I was, you know, already very much a cynic to begin with, and I brought that with me. However, the new regulations, you know, they require more fruits and vegetables. One of the horrible unintended consequences of those regulations is they put a cap on calories. And so if you read, I get Google alerts about school food on a daily basis, and the media is now all abuzz about the fact that kids are hungry. And kids were hungry before we put a cap on the calories, and now we're giving them less calories. And kids actually need calories, and they probably need more calories when they're eating foods that are nutrient depleted.
Right.
If you feed a child a nutrient-dense meal, they don't need as many calories. But in order to get just the minimum requirements of what their body needs for fuel, they need nutrients. And so if a potato is not full of all the vitamins and minerals, you probably need to eat more potatoes to get vitamins and minerals. And so it's no wonder that kids are complaining because they're getting fewer calories. And I think this is also one way to make the finances work is, you know, fewer calories, so less, you know, smaller portions, things don't cost as much. But I think it's really a missed opportunity to put these kinds of federal guidelines into place without any flexibility. So what the school districts that I follow and that are examples are doing is really creating their own standards and their own wellness policies. And this, to me, is the great opportunity, is that it's a local issue. So what's right for Tucson schools may not be right for the schools in Minnesota.
Exactly.
Or for the schools
exactly.
in New Hampshire or the schools in Florida. So your community can write its own wellness policy. You do have to follow the minimum guidelines of the National School Lunch Program, but they're not that hard to follow in reality because they're fairly minimal. And if you decide you want a program where you've got better quality ingredients, because those federal guidelines don't make any mention of the quality of the food whatsoever.
Right.
Just quantities of protein, which could come from, you know, any source, basically, and quantities of various nutrients. So when you look at your food as a local community, you can do better. And so really what I've tried to do is give parents resources to be able to create a policy in their school district that states exactly what they want to have in the district's lunch program. And you know, how do you hook up with a farmer? You might live in a small town or you might live in a big city where you don't have farms nearby. How do you connect with local farmers? How do you educate your lunch staff and teach them how to cook from scratch? So it's all of those
things. It's such a systems approach. I mean, it really is.
Yeah.
It's a systemic change that has to happen. And you're right, there are all of those pieces.
There's so many moving
parts.
Yeah,
it's complicated, moving parts. So the one of the things that happened here that is so hopeful, we have a food co-op that's wonderful, and they actually, they're very healthy financially, and they gave a loan to what we have a great farm here called Sleeping Frog Farm, and there are really sleeping frogs on it. That's how it was named, and they gave them money invested to help them expand their farming because they have so much capacity and the supply was not meeting the demand. And to me, that's another good story. I mean, that's a great story about good things happening. So, you know, if you give a mouse a cookie, they ask for a glass of milk. So two angry moms, then that wasn't enough. So you had to write a book called Lunch Wars, and now a new film you're working on, Canary Kids. So talk about
Canary Kids is not my film. I'm just advising it.
You're advising on it. Okay.
Yeah.
But it's another good news.
Exactly. It's another film that's going to really model things that can be done. So Lunch Wars really grew out of the fact that after I made the movie, I had so many emails, like hundreds of emails a day from people saying, how do I, from parents, from food service workers, from school administrators saying, okay, you know, we agree with what you're saying, but how do we do this? This
right,
is our problem.
Right.
And the problems would be money. The problems would be kids won't eat it. The problems would be lack of sourcing, lack of equipment, lack of facilities, lack of training, all of these things. And so every time somebody would write to me, I would kind of go through my files or dig around the internet and find answers to their questions. And after a while, I started compiling these templates that would answer their questions so that I wouldn't have to do this each time. And eventually, I kind of filled a hard drive full of information. So I was approached by a wonderful book agent who really encouraged me to do this book. And she led me through the process, which was great because I was not a published author prior to this. And the book is really a handbook. So it's got chapters that each one serves as resources to answer those kinds of practical questions so that anybody who wants to get in on any level, just even there's a whole chapter on how do I organize in my community? I'm the only one. Who cares about this? I can't do it alone. What do
right,
I do?
Right,
how do
right.
I find other people? And that was really where I started because I was not somebody who liked to speak in public, you know, very shy person. So I had to learn from the start how to organize and advocate. So there's a whole chapter on that. And then it grows from there. And then what to do about not just the food in the cafeteria, but food in the classrooms and vending machines and field trips and athletic events. And so all of those things are covered in ways that make it kind of very positive and tie it into educating our kids, and then also educating our communities, educating teachers and parents, so we're all learning about this together.
And it's so important. You know, I had breakfast a couple of weeks ago, and I think you might know this, but if not, you'll find it interesting. She is a dear friend, and she spent a week, 4 days at the Pentagon meeting with different people from the Department of Defense, even the undersecretary, about obesity in the military.
Yes.
So there you go. It's over 35% to 40%. And they were talking with her about a lot of these similar things. But it's so pervasive. And why that popped up is if your movement and all of the other great movements are successful, we've got that beaten down the road. It's a prevention of it. And people are more aware. I mean, I don't put food in my mouth, even if it's bad food, without thinking about it. Whereas I just used to eat. You know what I mean? It's just
Well,
here we go. We weren't, it wasn't as bad as TV dinners, but there were things that the consciousness wasn't there. We went through a whole generation of working moms and things changed. So,
It's a truly bipartisan issue, too, because,
awesome.
And that's one
yes.
reason I love it, because,
yes.
you know, when you talk about the military and you talk about national defense, you know, you're looking at a certain kind of political issue, but when you talk about children's health and whatnot, so one is kind of left and one is kind of right, but when you put them together and look at school food, one of the first things I learned when I was making the film, and I included this history in there, is that the National School Lunch Movement, the National School Lunch Program, rather, started as a national defense program because during World War II, they had to turn away so many recruits because they weren't fit for military service. They had all kinds of nutritional diseases like pellagra and things like that that we don't even hear about anymore. So what's happened now, and you were talking about your friend consulting, there's a report that just came out. I think it might have even only been in the past week or two. Hundreds of retired Army generals have gotten together and issued a report that's called Still Too Fat to Fight. Two years ago, they issued a report called Too Fat to Fight. So when I was researching for the book, I learned that the military had actually raised the maximum weight requirement for a new recruit because they couldn't get enough new soldiers, and this is recently, because everybody was too overweight to meet the requirement. So they raised that weight requirement. Even so, they are still finding so many potential recruits who are not eligible for military service because they are overweight or obese, and that it's a huge problem. So we've created, what was a solution to an earlier problem where people were undernourished.
Right.
We're now
right.
seeing people who are still undernourished, but they're overweight, and so the problem, that we did solve really well has now reversed itself again, and we need to find a new solution, and that's with nutrient-dense food that is actually good, high-quality food. So instead of just stuffing people with empty calories, we've got to start looking at the quality of that food.
And what happens is, once you eat an heirloom tomato, we get it at the farmer's market, and you put a little bit of balsamic vinegar on it, you're not, running down to Safeway to buy the ones that work. Picked really hard. I mean, I don't eat them. They don't taste like food to me. It's like I add them once in a while if tomatoes are not in season for color in a salad, but that's all they are. And then I don't have any because I think they're so disgusting. So we have 2 minutes left, believe it or not. How do people who want to get started all over the country listening to this, hopefully in the world, how do they get started? Where do they go? How do they find like-minded people in our community? I know the answer because I did sign up to become a part of it, but tell everybody.
Yay. Okay, we'll start at our website, which is angrymoms.org. And there's tons and tons of information. So you can just poke around. You can buy the movie. You can buy the book. But there's a link on that homepage of the website that's called Join the Movement.
Right.
And that brings you to a sister site, which is our social network. And that's a way to connect with other people in your area, in your local school district, and also to connect with people all over the country and even all over the world. So we've got a whole bunch of resources so that you don't have to start from scratch. The most important thing is to just do one thing, talk about it, meet with other people. And, you know, you can be that person who just, you know, says, I'm going to do this. I'm going to start a school garden. I'm going to teach kids how to make smoothies. I'm going to volunteer in the classroom. I'm going to find a farmer. I'm going to get a farmer's market going. Whatever it is, you know, it just pick one thing.
I just love that answer. And in my book that will come out eventually, I call Small Steps, Big Impact. Thank you so much for being a part of this. You can find information out about Amy by visiting and her movement by visiting Mrs. Green's World. Next week, Kate Lewis, USDA Bio Preferred Program. Thanks, everybody, for being here with us. Amy, best of luck, and let's stay connected. I'll do everything I can to pump up the volume.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Okay. Blessings.